Hello and welcome to The Front Page, the Racing Post programme which looks back at the key talking points and hot topics from the week. My name is James Stevens. I'm standing in for Lee Mottshead and Tom Kerr, who have enjoyed the delights of Paris this weekend for a wonderful art with a wonderful winner in Alpinista. But with brilliance in Longchamp, there was drama at Saint-Cloud. Christophe Soumillon elbowed fellow jockey Ross O'Ryan in one of the most controversial races we've seen all year. There is so much to discuss, and luckily we have a panel fit to do so. Sat beside me is Stuart Riley, ready for his front page debut, ready to convince me what should be on the front page. Stu, how are you, and are you feeling confident?
Yeah, very good, thanks, mate. How are you?
Yeah, very, very good. And we have another guest from Ireland joining us, David Jennings. David, good week so far?
Well, it's Monday, so the first few hours of the week have been all right, James. Yeah, as Monday mornings go, it's been good.
Good. And how was the weekend then? More importantly, did you enjoy the arc?
I did thoroughly enjoy the arc. Financially, it wasn't a particularly profitable weekend because Tenebrism let me down badly in the foray. Delighted to see obviously Alpinista win the arc and some brilliant supporting races. And there was a lot happening over the weekend. You'd almost forget like that Easy Game won the PWC Champion Chase at Goran Park, and that there was some brilliant racing at Tipperary at the weekend as well. So plenty to dissect, James.
Okay, and our first story of the week is over to you, DJ.
Yeah, so I'm going for the big one, the biggest flat race of the year, Europe's championship race. It was the Arc, and what an incredible story. An incredible race, an incredible story. Obviously, conditions did play a massive part, James, and it did turn into a proper slog. But there was something absolutely beautiful about seeing a jockey who gets fairly animated in Luke Morris in a finish. I think we'll all agree that his style is quite unique. But to see him sitting motionless, two out in an Arc, on a mare like Alpinista was it was just glorious to watch. And she handled conditions. She was tough when she needed to be. And I know the winning distance was a half a length of the line, but I think anybody watching the race will agree that she was far more superior than the winning margin suggested. She was in a different league on the day. Now, obviously, conditions played a big part. We didn't see the real Luxembourg, who was extremely disappointing. But Alpinista, what a story. Like, to win and put up a sequence as she's done tells you that she must be a star. And then there is the backstory behind her, and Kirsten Rousing being involved, Luke Morris obviously, who they say is the busiest jockey in England and the hardest working jockey. And then you've got Sir Mark. I brought Alistair down to Jack the Bromhead's funeral, collect him from the airport and then brought him back to the airport. And for some reason, I don't know why, but Sir Mark popped up in the conversation. And I'd say he took us from probably the middle of Kildare down to Waterford with Sir Mark's stories Alistair had, like about his dietary requirements and what he eats and how he doesn't really eat a lot of stuff, and the different times that Alistair had been there for dinner parties and the stories, and like hearing all about Heath House and, you know, how amazing. I've never been there, but it's one place I would love to go to. And I was just fascinated hearing all these stories. And that was one of the reasons I was so thrilled when I seen Sir Mark win the Arc, because he just sounds like one of the great characters of the game, and so unique. Like, he's such a unique character, and it was just a beautiful story. It was something new. It was something different. It wasn't Aidan O'Brien winning the Arc. It wasn't John Gosden winning the Arc. It was Luke Morris. It was Sir Mark Prescott. And for that reason, because, you know, in modern day racing, something like this doesn't happen very often. And I know the owner has more money than most people in the world, and almost everybody in the world, but it was still a really, really nice tale. And for that reason, James, it's blatantly obvious that that the Arc has to be on the front page this week.
That's very persuasive. Yeah, so that was the Arc. Alpinista, of course, an impressive winner for Sir Mark Prescott, Kirsten Rousing, the legendary trainer, as we've discussed, one of the most likable figures in the game, and a fantastic winner. Beat Vedini in second and Torquato Tasso, last year's winner. An eighth win in the Rovat for Alpinista, six of those are Group 1s, and blimey, what a fantastic story it was, Stu.
Yeah, it was utterly utterly enthralling. I thought it was a fantastic race and a fantastic ride by Luke Morris. I think the thing that impressed me most about Luke was he said beforehand, this is the biggest ride of his life. He was very aware of that. He went out and rode like he'd done it 1,000 times. It was the coolest ride that you've seen. It was the sort of ride that you would expect to see from someone who'd won 2 or 3 arcs before. Because he took a real risk turning in. When the cutaway came, and he stayed with a double handful instead of kicking on. Like, you think the easy thing to do at that point in that race is kick on. If something comes and gets her, you go, oh, I did everything I could, boss. He took the decision, he took the risk to wait. And actually, if you watch what then happened with Nashua and getting run down close home, it was really testing that day. You think the way when he went for his horse, like, she didn't quite pick up the way you thought she was going to. You thought she was going to lengthen away. She just sort of held that margin. And I think, like, that's where he won the race. In that moment where he decided to wait, he won it. And I thought it was a very brave ride for someone who doesn't get that many opportunities. And I think the other thing that I wanted to say on the ride was, I think it speaks a lot to A, his relationship with Sir Mark, but B, how Sir Mark must have managed going into that, because it would be very easy for Luke to get very caught up in all the different possibilities, and Mark very much must have taken that pressure off him and made him go out there relaxed, because it was the ride of a relaxed man. It wasn't the ride of a man, you know, on the biggest occasion of his life, feeling the stress of it all. So I thought, hats off to Luke Morris. It was a fantastic ride, and, you know, all around him who have helped keep him calm and keep him so relaxed that he can go out there and make such a bold decision. Like, I think, you know, my dad always said to me growing up, regret the thing that you did do, not the thing that you didn't. And that would be very easy if he'd sat and waited and something had done him close home. It would be very easy to regret that, much more so than if he'd kicked for home. So to make that decision and it proved the right one, I thought, hats off. It was a great ride.
Yeah, it was.
It's very rare that you see an arc, and from, I would say, definitely six out, there was only ever going to be one winner.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I'm on about the winning distance. Like, it didn't do her superiority justice. Like, no matter what you backed in the race, or no matter what horse you were watching in the race, every time you looked at Alpinista, and she was obviously very easy to spot because she's grey, it was blatantly obvious that she was travelling better than everything else. Mm. And when she kicked, the race was over. And I thought Richie Forrestal summed it up very well in his report. Like, it was emphatic. Like, it was one of the more emphatic arc victories, despite the distance being so narrow.
Well, it's a bit like See the Stars, wasn't it? In terms of, she was head and shoulders clear of everything else, for all the margin didn't suggest it. It was the manner that suggested it. She did it with such class, such ease. It was a bit like, you know, when Usain Bolt won that race and he was sort of smiling at the camera and pointing to the crowd. Like, there was an ease with which she travelled through the race. Not necessarily the final furlong, you know, it got a bit closer than I was expecting it to there. And you thought, oh, you know, is Torquatitasa going to come flying down the outside and do her? But yeah, the way she travelled through that race and the sort of confidence that Luke was exuding on her, it was from a long way out. She was knocking your eye out.
Absolutely. I spoke to Luke Morris on Friday, actually, and I said to him, come on, this is the biggest ride of your career. How nervous are you? And he was saying he was more focused on his rides at Wolverhampton, which I might not quite believe that bit. But one thing he did say, which I think was really interesting, he said that, I've had big rides and I've been nervous about them, but with this horse, I know her so well. I ride her out at home. I understand her. I know everything about her. So he felt that more confidence going into it. That was a really way he sort of looks at it and that relationship they've built up. And I think the final mention has to go to Frankel as well. A huge day for him in his stallion prospects. Now an arc-winning sire. So our second story of the week also comes from France. And Stu, you're going to talk us through this one.
Yeah, so there was a mind-blowing incident at Saint-Cloud on the Friday before Arc Weekend, where Christophe Soumillon, one of the most famous jockeys in international racing and multiple champion in France, committed one of just the most outrageous things I've ever seen on a race course, in that he was riding his mount. He by all accounts was trying to angle out off the rail and force a gap and just straight elbowed Ross Orion off his horse. I mean, the impact that Ross made with the ground and sort of his cartwheeling torso as the field came round the bend, it was a shocking visual. So much so that in the heat of the moment, you didn't quite realise what happened, and it wasn't until you watched replays afterwards that sort of the reality that he'd been elbowed off a horse came through. Like, you've seen riders come off in similar fashion when a saddle slipped or an iron's gone. But I think, you know, social media was ablaze. There was outrage. Clips coming in from left, right and centre. And, you know, there was only one other incident of something similar globally I saw in, you know, the history of the sport being televised, and that's an awful lot of races. There's, you know, millions of races worldwide. It's the sort of thing you just never see. It's such a big deal. You know, it was making mainstream news, both on television and main sports coverage in the papers. And it's, you know, been a real talking point. It was something that obviously France Gallo stepped in. Issued a 60-day ban. They came out and said that they would have loved to have been able to ban Christophe for the weekend, but weren't able to due to their rules, which they will be revisiting, such is the severity of this. You have had jockeys and trainers come out in sympathy with Christophe. Ruby Walsh described it as a racing manoeuvre gone wrong. And it's been a massive talking point. Christophe, for his, you know, and to his credit, has come out and apologised. He said sorry. He apparently had phoned Rosser himself and apologised to Rosser. That came from Rosser, who himself has, I don't know necessarily, like, has handled this for the minimum drama possible, I would say. Rosser hasn't complained about it. Rosser hasn't kicked off. He would have every right to.
Yep.
I think that, you know, if he'd wanted to, he would have been fully justified in... I think the Aga Khan's daughter, Princess Ara, summed it up perfectly. And sort of saying that A, they would be reevaluating their relationship with Christophe, and B, that he was just incredibly lucky that nothing worse happened, that Rosser was able to walk away from the incident. It was disturbing to watch. It was really, really unpleasant. It has been a talking point over the weekend. It is Monday and we're still talking about it, and it happened on Friday. There aren't many things in our sport that cause shockwaves and a ripple effect like that, and for that reason I think it is probably the front page story.
Yeah, true. Just to pick up on a couple of points you made there, it's a 60-day ban he's received. It'll start on October the 14th and last till December the 12th. So he won't miss many significant rides. He, of course, got to ride on Art Weekend, and that's something they're going to look into. Stu, how would you look back at that, and what would you say we should learn from it going forward? And was the right penalty given?
So what I think we can learn is... it's a difficult one, right? Yeah. How do you police these things? What is an appropriate punishment? Obviously, a 60-day ban in May is very different to a 60-day ban that starts in October for a flat jockey. I think also this is such a rare circumstance that you know. It isn't surprising necessarily that the rules in place don't adequately deal with it. I would take France Gallo at face value and that they will be addressing that. I think at the end of the day, the single most important thing is jockey safety and everything that we can do to protect that. Yeah. And I think there the message has to be severe, doesn't it? If you do something that puts somebody else's life at risk, like, put it this way, if two blokes were on motorbikes going 40 mile an hour down a road, yeah, and one of them pushed the other guy off, like, clean pushed him off, you know, you would be looking at severe criminal proceedings. So is a 60-day ban from riding horses adequate? Probably not in that light, but they are where the rules are currently. I imagine they won't be where the rules are if this ever happens again, and let's hope it doesn't, because, you know, I think everyone can say Rosser was probably lucky to walk away the way he did without any real injury, and he was riding at Ascot the next day. That if you ran that as a simulation 100 times, you know, the jockey does not walk away unscathed, or 100 of them.
No, that's very true. Yeah, I think personally I look at that as well and think that ban is probably quite short. I think as well the way we discipline our jockeys, for example, you know, he was able to ride on Art Weekend. It doesn't quite make sense. And I think for someone looking in at the sport, and if Fedini had won the Art, it's very difficult to sort of understand that and explain that. So I think there's some really key points. And the final thing is that ban, when that ban comes in, it's a less important time of the year. So I think that's something
it's
as well.
It's still 60 days. It's 60 days. Like, it's not, you're talking about it as if he's just missing a Monday afternoon. Like, it's still a chunky ban. Look, excuse me, my opinion on this is obviously a little bit different to my two esteemed colleagues here. But I think we, in racing and in sport in general, we get very much carried away in incidents like this. Number one point, I fully accept it was an absolute disgrace, okay? It was, should never have happened, and there is no place for anything like that in racing. It should never have happened. But we are all human, chaps. And the way we talk about these things is that none of us ever made any mistakes, ever. I've made about 10 already, and it's like 10:30 in the morning. Like, just listen to Ruby Walsh. Just to put it in perspective, I'm going to read you out this quote, okay? It's a racing maneuver, and Christoph did not get it right. He moved his body, his horse didn't follow, and he made contact with Ross O'Ryan, who falls off. It doesn't look good, okay? So just to talk about that point, it's a racing maneuver, okay? Obviously, we wish that there was no part of this in racing, okay? And you'd wish that elbows are not a part and that jockeys are not trying to, you know, hold their ground by using their elbows, and you wish it was squeaky clean. We all do, absolutely. But sport, like professional sport, is not squeaky clean, especially at this level. And obviously, if Ruby Walsh is saying this, this type of thing does happen in races. Christoph got this wrong, and like one thing led to another. His elbow went out too far. Rossa obviously wasn't prepared for what was to come, and because he wasn't prepared, he got an absolutely horrific fall, okay? But, like, I just think of maybe cycling, and I think of a, you know, a stage finish in the Tour de France, and you see the cyclists, and their arms, you know, they're fighting for their space, and their arms are out. Now, obviously, it's different. A bike and, you know, a thoroughbred is completely different. But I do think we are, you know, in general, likely to absolutely crucify jockeys for doing, you know, something wrong. I think he came out, he knew immediately, like he was with Alex Hammond on Sky Sports Racing within a couple of minutes of it happening. He knew immediately he had done wrong. Like, but to be, for the ARC to, or for the Aga Khan to be reevaluating their position with Christoph, I think that's mad. I think he made a mistake. He's paying for it. He's put his hands up. He's rang Rossa. He's completed an act of madness. He's got 60 days. Like, let's not just get carried away here. Let's realise that we're all human here. And in an absolute split of a split second, he made a decision to push his elbow out a little bit further. And that's it. Like, that's what he did. He was very lucky that Ross O'Ryan was okay. But to be thinking that this ban should be 6 months or a year, or he should be banned for life, or he should lose his job with the owner. Come on, lads.
DJ,
come on.
Can I ask you a question?
You can indeed.
If it had gone differently, if Rosser had come off at... No, I know it didn't. But if it had gone differently, you can't judge the punishment by the outcome, right? The crime is the crime. If you commit something, like whether the guy walks away from it or... And I don't want to put injuries out there upon Rosser. I don't feel that's a nice thing to do in the universe, right? But if Rosser had been in a far worse situation, if he had been injured, and like, let's go on the lighter side, he breaks a leg or he breaks an arm and he's out for, you know, a while, and he's banged up and he's in hospital. Like, I fully feel that a big part of you taking that approach is because Ross has walked away from this. If he put Rosser in hospital and things were bad, would you have the same position?
I still think 60 days is a fair punishment. I think, first of all, the outcry and the ban and the snappiness of the ban, like there was no hearing. It was bang, it was happening straight away. It wasn't like a referral and was pushed down the can. I think we needed to people and jockeys to realise that there's no place for this in racing. And if this does happen again, you know, that there's going to be severe punishment. So that's the first thing, and that was done. But I do think that 60 days, be it in September or October or May or June, is a pretty decent ban. I think the public scandal and the headlines that Christoph has been in, obviously, is part of the punishment as well. And I don't know. I think if God forbid, like Rossa, thank God he walked away. But like, if he did like happen to pick up a pretty serious injury, what are you saying? That Christoph should be banned for a year? For 2 years? I don't know. I just think the punishment probably in this case does fit the crime. But I don't think he deserved any more. And I think we probably, like listening to some of the reaction and reading it on social media and in different, you know, different pretty, you know, well-established people in the sport, like I think, you know, people make mistakes. We have to realize that. And this was a major mistake, but it's been dealt with now. And like, I just think we're getting carried away a little bit.
Yeah, I think two things on this. Like, to take the example that you made earlier with cycling, like if somebody does elbow somebody off in a sprint finish in cycling, like they are banned from the rest of the race, right? It's not, you can finish the Tour de France and then we'll punish you afterwards, which is effectively what's happened here with Christoph being able to ride for the rest of the weekend, and actually he can ride through to October
14th.
Those are
rules in racing.
No, I know, but in terms of the example that you used, like, yeah, in cycling he would have been banned immediately. So, you know, to use that example, the punishment from that example is that he would have been banned immediately. I also think this idea that, you know, it was a racing manoeuvre is stretching it, and I feel like it's an insult to our intelligence, right? Because it's all very well. But I'll tell you why. Because it's, for something to be a racing manoeuvre, it's something that happens all the time, right? And I am very aware that jockeys use their body to move other jockeys on a daily basis.
So jockeys, you just said it then. It doesn't happen.
Yeah, no. The jockeys use their body to move other jockeys happens. Jockeys do not elbow people off horses. That never happens. And I think if you take other sports, if you look at, like, if you say that this was a mistimed racing incident, right? You get mistimed incidents in football. You get bad tackles, right? You get late tackles. They happen every weekend because it's a question of timing and someone gets their timing out. The same with high tackles in rugby. They happen. We don't want them to happen, but they will continue to happen because it is, we're talking millimeters in instances, and it's a question of timing and the heat of the moment, and sometimes you go just that little bit too high and a high tackle goes in, and there will be high tackles every weekend that there's a rugby game, there will be late tackles every time there's a football game, right? People don't get elbowed off horses every time there's a day of horse racing. It never happens. People
Stuart, on that point then, what you're saying then basically is that Christoph Soumillon meant to elbow Ross O'Ryan. He wanted him to fall off his horse, and he wanted what happened to happen.
I'm not saying that at all, DJ. What I'm saying is, in the same way that if you clatter into somebody and you're a split second late, it's very different to another more malicious incident. Like the simple argument that this was a racing manoeuvre gone wrong and it was a matter of timing is completely undermined by the fact that this has never happened before. It doesn't happen. If it was a fine margin thing, there would be other examples. There are no other examples because there is no fine margin here. You have to have gone a long way past the fine margin for this to happen.
But maybe there were other sets of circumstances. You know, jockeys have their toes just about in the irons. Like, it's incredible the way they ride. Maybe at that specific moment when he felt the contact, he was slightly, ever so slightly off balance. And that's why he fell off the horse. Now, that is neither here nor there, and that shouldn't matter because he shouldn't be getting an elbow. My point is that Christoph made a mistake. And obviously, this type of thing does happen. If jockeys like Ruby Walsh are coming out and saying that it is a racing maneuver that has gone spectacularly wrong, like, it's not absolutely scandalous and the biggest disgrace of all time. It's not one of the worst things I've ever seen. And I just think it's been portrayed as that. And I personally don't think it is. I think it was an unfortunate set of circumstances that started out by a terrible decision on Christoph's part to do what he did. And especially in the part of the race that was in, because it was so early in the race. I think it's just a bad decision that went wrong. And I I think we probably went a little bit over the top in the criticism of Christoph. But look, I'm in a complete minority, and most people watching this show are going to agree with you, Stuart.
Very, very interesting discussion there. Very heated. I think we're going to have to put the stop on there. So, yeah, Christoph Soumian will be out for 60 days, and I'm sure we'll have so much more to talk about with this story to come in the coming weeks. We are set for a decision on whether he's going to retain that job. That's expected on Monday. We're still waiting for that news, so there's plenty to keep an eye on the Racing Post website for this story, which will continue evolving in the week to come. So the final story of the week is one I'm particularly excited about. The jump season returns on Friday. It's the big meeting at Chepstow, the two-day meeting, including the Persian War, which is traditionally seen as the start of the jump season. It's an interesting time for jump racing to come back. We've, of course, discussed quite a length in the studio about field sizes in the game. We've discussed attendances with the cost of living. We're still unsure about the economy and the current climate. How will racecourse attendances do during those winter months? Will racing thrive? Will racing's core jumps fans keep returning? There's so much to know. And what about the quality of the horses themselves? For the last few years, David Jennings has been smiling at the British disappointment at the Cheltenham Festival. Will it be the same story this year? So much to look forward to, Stu. What are you going to think going into the jump season? What stands out to you as the key stories?
Yeah, I think as you've touched on there, obviously we're in a strange and very difficult financial climate. As a country and you know, indeed globally, the impact that's going to have on our sport is already being felt and will only get worse as, you know, energy bills are starting to go up. Like, people's disposable income is getting vastly eroded and very quickly. A lot of people are struggling, and obviously, in situations like this, first and foremost, that is the most important thing, the human cost and the human impact of these things. Obviously, the impact it has on racing is of secondary concern, and, you know, it's important to acknowledge that. For all, it is going to have a big impact on our sport this winter. Will people be able to afford to go racing? I don't know. Will field sizes hold up and rebound? You know, it's one of those things where, on the one hand, yes, if we've the right ground and, you know, we've a whole load of horses that have had the summer off, there should be the demand there. But then on the flip side, you know, novice contests in particular are always ripe for small fields, especially, you know, those novice chases where you have those good, exciting young hurdlers going chasing. Nobody wants to take them on. You get a good novice, and those graded races are almost always small fields. So I think small field sizes will continue to run as a story. I think Irish dominance will also continue to run as a story. It's not the sort of thing that can be turned around that quickly. Like, at the end of the day, it's a bit like Man City at the weekend. If you've got all the best players in your team, you know, Man United can go and get in a new manager, make a few signings, but they're not going to turn around that deficit in one summer. British racing can't turn around the deficit it has with Ireland in one summer. What you want to see, I guess, is being more competitive in those younger races, the bumpers, the novice hurdles. That would suggest the new wave through can perhaps start to redress that balance. But I fully expect all the best young horses to be in Ireland, because that's where they keep going. That's where the trainers have the owners with the money to spend on them. It's where, you know, you have trainers like Willie Mullins, Gordon Elliott, Henry de Bromhead, who are able to produce these superstars year after year. You know, you think Paul Nicholls had that incredible era with Corto and Denman and Big Bucks and Masterminded, and he's obviously had some very talented horses since, you know, the likes of Silvaniaco Conti, Brave Man's Game being the sort of latest Paul Nicholls superstar. But you think how hard Paul has found it to find a horse of that caliber, and yet, you know, Mullins, Elliott, de Bromhead, they're churning these horses out year after year. There's new superstar after new superstar, and that isn't a balance that can be redressed in a summer off.
Yeah, I think that's some really interesting points you make. And I mean, we don't want to go touch too much on Cheltenham because it is so far away. But I think that's going to be one of the interesting factors personally to see how campaigning has changed. You know, Paul Nicholls is a really good example. You know, Klander Zobo is a horse. Yeah. He went there. he lost, and now he's changed, and he's just picking his program out to make sure he avoids those harder horses to beat in Ireland. And it's interesting. I think that the pattern itself, the race program, is continually under the eye. It's going to be under the eye a lot more, not just because of field sizes, but because of the quality of the races. You know, there has been calls that there's too many of those novice races. You know, the field sizes, those qualities not there. Very interesting comments. David, we touched on there the sort of English-Irish divide. Ireland look very, very strong at the minute, as we know. What are you looking forward to this season in particular?
Well, I think it'd be easy to say, what am I not looking forward to, James? I always think when the arc is over, you just cannot wait for like the Coral, is it the Coral Gold Cup now, as it's called? The Paddy Power Chase in November,
Newbury,
in Newbury. And like all those races, I'm just getting like proper excited thinking about them now. So yeah, but like you just look through, like obviously we don't want to be starting talking about Cheltenham in, you know, the third day of October, but just it gives you a flavour of what the season is going to be like when you look through the anti-post markets and you see like Supreme Novice Hurdle, Facile Vega favourite, Redemption Day second favourite, now Champ Kylie third favourite, Hunter's Yarn fourth favourite. Like the first four in the market are Willie Mullins. Then you've got, you know, in the Arkle, he's got potentially Sir Gerhard, El Fabiolo, Appreciated. And then you just go through all the different races, like even, you know, the Ballymore, again, James's Gate could potentially go there. Facile Vega is another one. And then you go as novice chasers. He's got the Nice Guy, who's favourite for the Brown Advisory. It is just incredible when you see the depth that he has in the those different divisions, novice hurdlers, novice chase. And then you say, well, what's he like in the open divisions, I wonder? Oh, wait, he's actually got the favourite for the Gold Cup now in Gallop and the Champs. He's got the favourite in the champion chase in the defending champion, Energy Mean. And you're going, holy God, like how much dominance could one person have this season? It's kind of scary. Now, it doesn't always work like that. And there are seasons where, you know, things go wrong and horses get injured. But in my time in racing, and this is a big claim, in my time in racing, which is probably, you know, 17, 18 years covering racing now, I can never remember Willie Mullins being so dominant and potentially, you know, have so much firepower going into a season. Like, and you think of the seasons that he's had in the past, like this is scary, the amount of, you know, top notchers that he has. The O'Learys are back in the stable now as well, so you know, for the rest it is worrying. I do think Gordon has done very well in rebuilding what could have potentially been, you know, a career threatening moment a couple of years ago, because he's bought young, talented, well-bred horses, he spent money, and he's now got, you know, 4, 5, and 6-year-olds that have the potential in the next couple of years to get him back up to the level where, you know, he could be challenging for a trainer's title. I think basically winning that trainer's title in Ireland is a long way away, but he has bought young horses and he is building for the future, and he's going to have patience, but I think he's done well. And then you've got Henry de Bromhead, who's obviously got Honeysuckle, who's going to bid for a third champion hurdle as unbeaten, and he's got Apu Tara as well, who's the reigning Gold Cup champion. So there is a lot of strength and depth in Ireland. There really, really is. And it's hard to believe that that's going to change now. And we could see it quite early, horses from Ireland coming over to Britain, because obviously Apu Tara will go for the Betfair Chase again. And I wouldn't be surprised to see the likes of maybe Conflated in there as well, because he needs to go left-handed. So you could potentially see Irish horses running in Britain very early this season.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. And you mentioned sort of the strength that Willie Mullins has. I mean, he wants to divide his horses up, he'll want horses not to take each other on, so I think it's inevitable that we are possibly going to see a few more Willie Mullins runners over. I need to get both a dark horse from you. DJ, have you found us an Epsom Crow?
Do we want to find the next Sam Crow? That's a bit like saying, have you found the next journalist in Ireland that's like David Jennings? A massive disappointment. My dark horse to follow, I don't think this has ever happened before in the history of following dark horses, but my dark horse to follow is the same dark horse that I put up last season as my dark horse to follow, but he never ran. I think Firestep from the Nicky Henderson stable is potentially going to be a star. I think he's definitely a grade one horse in the making, and I think maybe an extra year might have done him good. He's a 6-year-old now. He's only ran twice, and I literally could just replay what I've said on shows like this last year. Obviously there wasn't the front page last year, but on different podcasts. He won a bumper at Suddle first time out, and it was kind of, I was working and he was in the background and I was like, whoa, what's that horse? He's a gorgeous, imposing looking horse. And I had to check him out and I said, what is this horse like? Because he was so keen in the early part of the race and he really finished out with his race. And then next time he went to Chepstow for a winner's bumper, and again, he he travels so powerfully through the race, and he's only a shell of a horse compared to what he's going to be. Now, the form has worked out okay. It's nothing spectacular, but it was just what he did, having been keen and travelling powerfully, what he did in the final furlong, and still won quite comfortably at the line. Like, Nico de Boinville was at pains to give him an easy race. And I actually went to Seven Barrows last year for a DJ on tour series, which I hope they're going to send me again. I was chatting to Nicky at the time, and I said, "What area of your stable are you most looking forward to? Like, or department would be a better word there, actually. What department of your stable are you most looking forward to?" I was thinking he'd say, you know, Shishkin, maybe the Open Chasers or something. He goes, "We have an incredible bunch of novice hurdlers." And at the time, nobody heard tell of Constitution Hill. John Bond obviously was potentially a star, but was still like a big enough price for the Supreme. And I couldn't find any of the rest of them. And I said to him, "Do you know what, Nicky? I really like a horse called Firestep." And he goes, "Oh, yes." He goes, "He's one of the better ones." He says, "I can't wait to see him either." And he was talking about him in the John Bond, maybe Constitution Hill and a few others in that kind of category. In the top five or six novice hurdlers was Firestep. So he was in my tracker. And I had to check to make sure I had him in my tracker last year, because I was getting no emails whatsoever that he was going to run. He never ran. Apparently, they've given him another year. He's ready to return. And I think Firestep could potentially be next year's maybe Ballymore winner. Maybe. He won't be Facile Vega, but I think he's very good.
Only David Jennings could talk about the Irish dominance and then give us a British trained horse, couldn't he? Stu, what have you got for us?
I've also got a British trained horse, also a bumper winner. Probably won't be one of the best five or six novice hurdlers that Oliver Sherwood has. I suspect it'll be the best novice hurdler that Oliver Sherwood has, such as that dominant trainer thing. We have that over here as well. The likes of Nicky Henderson and Paul Nichols have an amount of riches that other trainers can only dream of. But I think Oliver Sherwood has a good one in a horse called Queen's Gamble. Won a bumper at Cheltenham back end of last season and was really impressive. Won by 10 lengths, looked really good. Obviously, it's one run in a bumper. It can mean nothing, and it can turn out to all have been very impressive for no reason, but I really caught my eye. I was very impressed. We'll have the advantage of being, I don't doubt, the Oliver's number one novice hurdler for this season, and being treated and race planned accordingly. I think I was just so impressed by the way it won, and I can't. I can't wait to see him back this season and see where he goes. I think it'll be a really interesting campaign and definitely a horse to keep on the radar.
Yeah, no, I was there that day when really impressive winner, and Oliver's comments after the race. It was an important winner for him. He'd obviously had some health problems and the like, but this was a horse that you could see really felt that this has huge potential. So exciting horse nonetheless. I was going to say Alto Belly going into the week, but I've read a few horses to follow, and it appears that this horse is no longer dark. He's quite bright, if anything. So I went to see Nicky Martin's Bear Gills not too long ago. And,
I like him.
I like him too, but she said there's a horse that she also has a sort of similar view about, a horse called Leading Choice, who won despite not really travelling, having all sorts of difficulty at Fosse Lask, went to Cheltenham and travelled very, very well, a lot better that day, if anything, went down the hill and just couldn't do it. Big expectations for him, and similar to do Bear Gills, and God, I'd love Bear Gills to have a good year. So yes, plenty to look forward to. It all starts at Chepstow this week. Some big races to come. We've got the November meeting, the King George, the Coral Gold Cup, which hopefully 3 under 5 is going to win this year, David Jennings. But yes, plenty to look forward to for the jumps this season. So that's the final story of the week. I've had a think. As much as I like the jumps, I think it's just that tad too early to make the front page. David, I thought the Ark was a fantastic winner, a really, really good story, and quite rightly gets a great place on our front page. But I think, just given the nature of the drama between you two in the studio here and over in Ireland for you, DJ, I think Christoph Soumillon has to be on the front page. It was a massive story, and I think it's one that's going to continue to evolve. So, yeah, three huge stories there. Thank you very much for joining us, and we will be back next week for more discussions about racing's hottest topics.